The precariousness of rentier cultures. The word rentier, meaning a person living off unearned income, comes from the French, as do so many other words connected with money and plunder. Financier, profiteer, buccaneer. Over the last four centuries, however, it was first Spain, then Holland and Great Britain, and now the United States that created the most notable rentier cultures. Each ultimately became vulnerable as a result. Spain needs little further discussion, save for how its mounds of indebtedness bred an unproductive economic culture. When the initial large amounts of gold and silver arrived between 1540 and 1560, the financial system of Castile was late medieval, not commercially adept in the manner of Renaissance Italy's mercantile and banking centers. However, the flood of bullion enabled the crown to borrow hitherto unimaginable sums for grandiose purposes, often military campaigns. By 1574, with the crown having gone through a kind of bankruptcy in 1557, King Philip II was already paying interest to his bankers in an amount that exceeded his revenues. Debt instruments, most of them juros in at least a dozen varieties, had been official money-raising tools since the days of Ferdinand and Isabella. The royal treasury not only sold juros, but required subjects to accept them in payment when the king sequestered private shipments of bullion, seized businesses or estates, ordered renegotiation of short-term loans, a practice concomitant with the royal bankruptcies, and pressured nobles, merchants, or monasteries into making loans. With interest usually in the 5-7% range, many foreign bankers and financiers also subscribed. The volume of juros swelled rapidly. In the words of one economic historian, never before had Western Europe enjoyed the buoyant sense of access to such unparalleled financial resources, promising liquidity for both private and public enterprise. In 1598, perhaps as much as 4.6 million ducados annually were being paid to juro holders from a royal budget of 9.7 million. In the 17th century, Philip IV managed to expand the public debt to 12 times Castile's annual revenues. At the century's end, these instruments, now the foundations of Spain's long-term debt, allowed Spain's clases privilegiadas to live off interest income. The upshot, said a second historian, was the growth of a powerful rentier class in Castile, investing its money not in trade or industry, but in bonds, the redemption of which most holders strongly opposed. In 1617, the Council of Finance acknowledged seeing no chance for an economic revival in Castile so long as censos and juros paid better interest than that to be had from investments in agriculture, industry, and trade. A few decades later, the debt economy itself came unglued. The Dutch, obviously, were a different people. Yet they got to much the same place, albeit by a different route. To raise the money for their revolution against Spain and Catholicism, they set up a funded debt and backed it with heavy levels of taxation. Not only did this patriotic commitment bring in the necessary funds, but it soon made Dutch bonds among the most creditworthy in Europe. Financing available at 5% interest also established early 17th century Amsterdam as the West's principal trade entrepot and stock market, making many Dutch merchants and bankers rich. In contrast to bullion-drenched but fiscally fumbling Castile, the Netherlands was ruled by the same somber Calvinists and capitalists who both underwrote the bonds and bought many of them. According to investment historian James MacDonald, some 65,000 Dutch citizen creditors held bonds in a nation that had only 100,000 urban households. Because the officers of the state themselves held large portions of their fortunes in government debt, every public creditor could be sure that his investment was safe. By the middle of the 17th century, however, the urban and provincial leadership groups were no longer active merchants, but rentiers deriving their income from houses, lands, and money at interest. Generations later, when Dutch industry was notably declining, mid-18th century critics worried, as had Spanish reformers, about a nation divided between rentiers and beggars. Historian Simon Schama has described the aristocratization of the Dutch Republic, which some regarded as a betrayal of the nation's patrimony. By another account, the typical mid-18th century family of the governing or regent class had 57% of its assets in Dutch bonds and more than 25% in shares, obligations, and foreign funds. A Dutch economic writer, Isaac Pinto, worried that such bonds, shares, and foreign funds were the linchpin of civic wealth and status, the principal pillar of the social system, a situation quite unlike that existing in other countries. As Dutch society moved toward the credit crises, panics, and collapses of the last three decades of the 18th century, critics grew more pointed. 70 years ago, one foreign observer recorded in 1771, the wealthiest businessman in Amsterdam did not have gardens or country houses comparable to those their brokers own today. The worst thing is not the building and immense expense of maintaining these fairy tale palaces. It is that the distraction and negligence occasioned by this luxury often causes prejudice to business and trade. A further symptom of the collapse, observed historian Jonathan Israel, was the astounding increase and transfer of Dutch capital abroad. Amsterdam banking houses with foreign connections plied a roaring business throughout the 18th century in exporting the capital the United Provinces had accumulated during the 17th century.